Good evening and welcome to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric, the only podcast out there that takes two of your favorite movies and puts them head-to-head in Mortal Kombat for your entertainment. Enjoy the show tonight, guys. We have Almost Famous against Eddie and the Cruisers.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle.
Hi, I'm Greg, and I'm a nerd.
Aren't you?
I have never seen anything like this.
The worst part has been watching the actual watching of the movie.
Some of these were pretty terrible.
We are back again. Welcome to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. It's a nice, cold, frigid day across the United States of A. It's crazy how cold it is out there. Now, you're in Dallas, and you got some of this stuff.
Reporting live from Dallas, Greg. Here's a weather update. It's fucking cold. And we haven't had any precipitation in quite a while, but it just is like nothing will go away. And we're more, it seems, capable or prepared to deal with like 123 degree weather as opposed to 23 degree weather. And so it's just an ice rink out there, and the kids can't go to school, and driving me crazy, and I'm driving them crazy, and this sucks. You got to get me out of here.
How many inches did you get?
Well, God blessed me with about 2 inches, Greg. Thanks for asking. And that's semi-hard, which is about all I can get anymore. So I don't know what that has to do with anything. It was an easy way for me to measure the snowfall because it was about an inch. No, we didn't get as much as they made it seem like, you know, Icemageddon 2026. Right. The stores obviously picked over. All the water is gone. All the water except Dasani. No one shit. And yeah, man, it's not been fun, but it's definitely not minus 22 degrees like it is where you're at.
Yeah, right now the wind chill is -3, but they have put out an alert that it's going to get down to -22 wind chill wise. I think temperature wise 11, something like that. So
this one goes to 11.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We wish it went higher than 11, actually. But yeah, we had record snowfall here in Dayton, Ohio. It was around 14 inches, so which was insane. So
which you could also easily measure.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
it was. But it was. Just put it in and go. Okay, subtract 2.
Carry the 9. Denominator. Yeah,
but we got lucky. We bought a snow plow this year. This was the first, because we've lived here for a while and we've always like been out there shoveling, and we have a huge driveway because we're in a private lane with like 2 other houses that we share. It's not as ritzy as it sounds.
Do you have the Four Seasons pulled up? Bum, bum, bum,
bum, no. But we have this long-ass driveway that all 3 houses are responsible for, and it's just a pain in the ass. We'd all be out there with shovels, but 2 of us now have snow blowers. So we were out there like 3 or 4 times during the day on Sunday getting rid of all the snow. And it was worth it. It's clear now. It's just cold as hell right now.
Does such a thing exist as like a Roomba, but it's for snow blowing?
I don't know, but they have it for lawn mowing. We have a neighbor that has one of those things for lawn mowing. It's the coolest thing. I mean, when you do it with a lawnmower, you don't get like, you know, you mow your lawn and it's like a straight line and you can make it look really cool. This thing is not it. I'll go by the dude's house and his dogs are chasing it and it's just backing up and just cutting all the grass. I'm like, well, at least get your grass cut, but yeah.
Yeah, it like calculates the like shortest distance between 2 points, and so it's just 1, 2, 3.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, if there was ever a fun part of being responsible for mowing the lawn growing up, is that you took pride in those angles. We had yard on each side of our straight, you know, walkway going up to the front door. And so I would do diagonals, you know, towards the thing. And I mean, yeah, you stand out there and go, this is badass. I can't imagine just kind of just running all over into whatever. But I don't know.
You have to weigh the pros and cons. I'm inside with a beer watching the game and the Roomba's doing all the work, or I'm out there for a couple hours. My thing is my wife is the one who like really scrutinizes the job I do on the lawn. And so I get very self-conscious about that shit.
Don't let her make you feel that way.
I know, right? I shouldn't, but I'm like trying to make sure the lines are exactly perfect, and I'll do everything I can. I'll make one little slip up and I'll know, I messed up, and it'll screw up. And I'll come back in the house. The first thing she does is, what happened over there? what is that piece of shit over there? What's that?
She just kind of gives you this sad, pathetic look. I can't believe I had fucking kids with you.
Yeah, exactly. It's the measure of a man is how neatly they can mow a blade of grass.
Well, later I'll tell you something you can tell her next time she wants to talk some bullshit about how the yard's looking.
Okay. You said later on?
It'd be really easy for me to tell you to say it because I don't have to say it to her. Mm-mm. And so that's always the thing. Like, I have some really good advice for her. You should just tell her to fucking shove it up her ass. Have fun doing that because I don't have to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And no, so I'm really good at giving advice like that. I'm not good at receiving advice like that.
Yeah, that doesn't happen around here. We just, I just take it.
Look at you. Yeah. Well, listen, there's something to be said about just bending over and spreading them.
Yeah. That's how life is. When you get to be my age and married this long, you've learned just to take it. That's how it works in this household. But
well,
anyway.
Good. Well, you're not snowed in. You're just hanging out. You don't have to go to the office.
And yeah, actually, yeah. Don't have to go to the office this week. The base is shut down, basically. So it's nice. I'll be home just teleworking this week. So and we have time to do something like this and talk about movies that we love, which we try to do every other week. That's why we're here tonight. Right now we're doing the Battle of the Fake Movie Bands, or the movie bands. Bands that don't really exist in real life, but they're so damn good. They made movies about them that don't really exist. All right, we'll get into that.
I don't know.
I think one of these two Eric doesn't really care for, but we're going to find out as we get into it. So before we get into that, I want to say again, welcome to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We are live right now on YouTube, Twitch, and Facebook Live. You can see there on the bottom right of the screen our email address. If you want to email us a suggestion or a comment, go ahead and do that at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. But if you want to follow us, our live streams, you can catch us on our Facebook, or you can catch us on our Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod, or YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast. We ask that you just spread the word. We stream on just about every platform out there, but we're on the big ones, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Podcasts, Stitcher, all these things. We're on everyone. Podbean, we're on that. You name it, we're on it.
That's enough.
Is that enough?
I don't know. That seems like, hey, have we ever got an email, like an actual email that wasn't dick pills or like a very obvious Indian scam where they want you to buy gift cards?
Yes. It's usually from our regulars. So we have like saying hi to Mike Leblanovitz or Mike Florida in the audience. He's happy to be here. He's with us each and every week. So we're glad to see him there. He said there's no snow in Madeira Beach. It's 42 degrees though, so lucky for him.
Is Madeira Beach like the hillbilly part of Florida, or is it the like touristy part of Florida? Let's just see.
You're gonna look it up. You're gonna Google
Madeira.
Oh, you need to see it again. Do you want to leave it up on the screen there? Madeira.
It's fine. I found it. It's where the fuck is this, man? I don't. Oh, it's by St. Pete. Okay, somewhere near St. Pete. So that's kind of not the hillbilly part.
Yep.
Okay.
But he's with us. And yeah, so we do get occasional emails. We get them from our regulars. So that reach out and say, hey, I've got an idea for this and that. So it's nice. So if you want to send us an email, yes, please do.
Don't send us an email and try to tell us our fucking business. We'll figure out the shows. You don't tell us shit. I don't want to hear.
I'm a little more open to suggestions.
I'm not. My heart is not open to your suggestions.
He's the stubborn one. So let's get into where we're at on these movie bands battles that we've been doing. We had our first, our last episode between This Is Spinal Tap and Sing Street. It was a close battle, but This Is Spinal Tap was clearly the winner. And these are the rest of the brackets that we have coming up over the next several weeks as we declare who is the best, what is the best movie about a fictional band. And tonight we have, two. Now, you may not like one of these, Eric. You're giving me the vibes you don't like one of these. But these are two iconic movies about fake bands. They are. They're both of them have been...
Well, guess what? Hitler was iconic.
Okay. I won't deny that. But,
all right.
But you can talk to most people in Generation X or people that have been around since 2000, and they will know these two films. Maybe not the people outside of Generation X, No Eddie and the Cruisers, but other people do. So we're having Almost Famous against Eddie and the Cruisers tonight.
I'm sorry. I got distracted because I was reading a comment. You're telling me that anyone born from 2000 prior knows Eddie and the Cruisers or 2000?
No, I said that anybody around 2000 would know Almost Famous.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot more sense.
Anybody that was growing up around the 2000s, but anybody that's a Gen Xer would know Eddie and the Cruisers.
He's going to know this piece of shit. Okay.
I think we figured out which one Eric does not like.
Which one do we start with? It's the lower seats.
So we are starting with Eddie and the Cruisers.
Oh, okay. Well, Greg, what do you think of Eddie and the Cruisers? This is a classic. This is Eddie Wilson, the story of Eddie Wilson. Ellen Barkin starts this thing out. She is an investigative reporter, and she's going to find... I mean, is it just me, or was she, like, way hotter, like, 40 years after this in Ocean's 13? Because, like, she's pretty here, but yeah. In Ocean's 13, and she was, like, 70, and, like, she looked good. Who's the oldest person on earth, Greg, that you think that you'd, if you weren't married, that you think you'd want to get it on with?
You know what? I don't even have to hesitate about this. It would be Anne Margaret. Wouldn't even think twice.
She's still alive?
She's still alive, as far as I know. I believe so. She was on a show called Happy, a sci-fi channel show. It was a comedy about a guy who has an alter ego that's like a colorful unicorn. It was a quirky sci-fi show. It was really funny. And she was in there in one episode, and she still looked good. I don't know how old she is. I think she's pushing 80 or in the 80s, but...
She's 83, and fans are worried about her.
Yeah.
I hope when I'm 83, people are worried about me.
My
answer would be David Letterman.
Nice. That's good.
Anyway. Yeah, so I don't know. What do you... I mean... I didn't enjoy this even a little bit.
I had a feeling. All right, so let's talk about this movie real quick. There are a lot of people, my age, I'm a Gen Xer. I was born in the 70s. And when this movie came out, I was a teenager. And it wasn't something that anybody really talked about until... There's a lot of movies that didn't do well in the movie theater, and this is one of them. But then when HBO and Cinemax got a hold of them and Showtime, which were all kind of new post-1980, they would show these things nonstop. Roller Boogie that we had on a previous episode is one of those films. Scavenger Hunt, I remember, used to be on all the time. Kramer versus Kramer, all these films. You would see these ones because they needed content. So they would play these over and over. And Eddie and the Cruisers was one of those films that you couldn't escape. And then you had the song that opens on the Dark Side by John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band. And it hit MTV, and everybody loved the video. So then people would tune in to the movie as well. Going into the viewing of this movie, which I had not seen since maybe the early 90s, my wife sat down to watch it with me. She does occasionally, just to get her opinion on it as well. And she was kind of excited because this was kind of a piece of our teenage years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to lie. When it was over, she looked at me and went, well, that didn't age well.
Okay, good.
That's not as good as I remember it in the 80s. And I would challenge a lot of people because we have, you know, somebody here. This is Frank Carlone, 5130. Eddie and the Cruisers is a good movie, but this is no brainer. Almost Famous is legendary. So this is almost over before it begins, this battle. But, you know, it is a good movie. I would challenge anybody that loves it to go and rewatch it now. And it's still not, for me, it wasn't bad. We enjoyed the musical numbers and stuff like that. We enjoyed parts of it. I liked Tom Berenger in it. But it was kind of funny that we felt that it was a good movie that missed a lot of opportunities to be a great movie.
Every opportunity, honestly.
No, seriously. Had they just done I'm gonna wrinkle you for this, a biopic about Eric performs.
Why do you say it like that?
Because I like saying it that way just to ruffle your feathers. But a biopic. Okay. If they had just done a biopic about a former music star that died in a crash, and they relived, you know, his life kind of like a regular biopic does, and had the musical numbers and kind of had these things. What I think weighs this film down is this pervasiveness of the reporter going and trying to unravel the mystery behind these lost tapes and who killed him. And it keeps dragging the film down, because when they go that route, anything that's interesting about the film, the things that are most interesting are the musical numbers. Granted, if you like them or not, but I'm just saying at that time, it's very Springsteen-esque. It was very inspired by Springsteen. And John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band do a really good job with the soundtrack. Soundtrack did really well.
Yeah.
You know, it's that type of Jersey rock. And it had some qualities that people really enjoyed. But it's like when they get into that, where are the tapes and all the intrigue and the saxophonist who never gets to say a word in the entire film ends up dead. It's like, what is going on with this film?
So you're touching on a point that I strongly, strongly agree with. So this movie is an hour and 34 minutes. You don't have a lot of time to do what you're trying to do here. Well, they chose not to have that time. So you're right. If they were to make it a biopic.
You said it. I didn't.
My watch is telling me that my heart rate is through the roof. It's worried about me. If they wanted to make it a biopic, then you can go that route.
Right.
And then it can be his story plus the musical numbers. The problem is, like you said, is that they kept going back to this, like, it's a mystery. It's a whodunit, except it is not mysterious at all.
No.
So you either needed to add something. Oh, my God, I'm going to die. No, cut that out in post. So you either needed to flesh that out a little more and make it 45 minutes of the movie and use the other 45 for your musical numbers. Honestly, Greg, and I didn't hate the music. I will say, to try to convince me that music would be popular in 1963 is, I don't know. It's fine. Don't make it sound like Bruce Springsteen, who, by the way, is one of the top three most overrated musical acts of all fucking time. I swear to God, sit down, listen, pull up Spotify, pull up Bruce Springsteen and just hit like randomize.
Yeah.
And you'll want to fucking kill yourself in 12 minutes. This shit's fucking terrible.
Again, send your emails at boxofficebattles@gmail.com to let Eric know just how you think about his opinions of
the Bruce other Springsteen. Two on the list are AC/DC and The Doors, by the way. So you can just go ahead and just get that.
Just get them all out of the way.
So I felt like I kept waiting for there to be a story, and all I'm getting is musical number after musical number after musical number. So, and that's fine. I don't mind musical number. They weren't bad. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it kept getting in the way of the story. And every time I thought we were about to get a story, now we're on the patio of our riverfront Jersey house writing more music. And every time I think that we're about to get somewhere else, now we're a lounge act doing Eddie and the Cruisers covers. And every time I think we're doing this, I'm just like, okay, then take that, the two songs that were the weakest of all of them, which were In the Dark or What the Fuck Ever, The Dark Side.
On the Dark Side, the one that was like a top 10 hit in the U.S., dude, that's the weakest one.
I just say, you just sit down and think about what the two or three worst numbers were on there. Cut those out, flesh out a story a little better, and maybe you've got something to work with. But, I mean, I've never had an ending of a movie be so unfulfilling as this.
Yeah, no.
I mean, everything about it, her react, like, there's a part of me in that final scene that thinks, like, maybe she's psychotic and maybe she's having these visions that he's still alive and she's behind all this. Kinda. I keep thinking maybe this DJ's got something to do with it. Well, in the most paper thin way, yes. Like, everything is so paper thin. I couldn't get over how much of a nothing burger this story was, and it was just not enjoyable to me at all.
We found it both kind of like, my wife and I gave, you know, when you're watching a movie and something happens that's just so over the top ridiculous, and you glance at your partner and just look at him like, are you watching what I'm watching? It's the scene where Joe Pantoliano, who plays the DJ and the former manager of the group, who is the one that's been trying to get the lost tapes so he can sell them for millions of dollars because it's more Eddie material, and they reveal. So if you haven't seen the movie, spoiler alert, but they reveal that he's the one that's been doing all of this stuff, terrorizing everybody, and Eddie grabs him and he's going to rough him up a little bit, and then what do? They
give him the tapes.
Give him the tapes and let him go. And it's like, what? And so the thing was, is that I think when I watched it in the 80s, and again, I didn't have any bad memories of it. It's like, I didn't really focus on the story. That just was like in the background. It's one of those films, like I said, it was on HBO all the time. So you just had it on and the songs would come on and you'd be like, yeah, do, do, do. It was like and again, you got to think, this is the start of MTV and the music video era in the early 80s. And so this video was on all the time. So the movie's on all the time. It's almost like you had music videos on. And so people remember it very fondly. But as a story, you're exactly right. What I found really odd that when we were watching it, because we watched it before Almost Famous, and I thought, wow, in a small way, this has some similarities to Almost Famous that they really dropped the ball on. Namely, the Tom Berenger character, who's kind of sweeping up Joe, that he wants to be a part of this group, and they bring him in almost like Patrick Fugit's character in Almost Famous, where he gets into this world where he's an outsider and he gets to experience the world firsthand, and then he can kind of see that it's not everything he thought it was going to be. Had the movie stayed down that road and done away with the murder mystery, missing tapes nonsense, that would have been such a better movie to have this clash, because they do some good scenes, like when Tom Berenger's character ends up trying to romance Eddie's girl, Joanne. Is it Joanne? No? It was Joanne Carlino. Yeah, Joanne Carlino. Tom Berenger plays Frank Ridgway. So when Frank is romancing Joanne, who's technically with Eddie, and they start, you know, hooking up, and it builds this friction between the two, and he starts, you know, bad-mouthing him on stage, that's where the movie should have focused more of its energy, is the dynamic between the two characters and how he brings this guy in and it's not what he seems. Substance abuse, things, all that breaks up bands. Instead, we get, like you said, the lounge singer scene where he's going, reliving the past. And some of these scenes with the forward scenes, not the flashbacks, but when they're talking to people in the present and they're telling their stories of Eddie, they went on far too long. Because you just want to get back into the Eddie story. You don't really want to sit there and watch him smoking a cigarette and talking for 5 minutes.
Yeah, all you had to do was choose one tack and just go with it.
Yeah.
And they just chose none of them. It just felt flimsy. And I mean, and I'm sorry, but I wasn't 5 minutes into this thing groaning when they're like, we brought him in because he's a lyricist. That's why we call him the word man. Like, are you fucking like, yeah. You're just a word man, word man. He just writes the words, so we call him word man. Like, that was fucking clever or some shit.
That is pretty funny.
You know what? I used to play basketball. You know what we called it? B-ball, Greg. We called it B-ball.
You were B-ball man.
Wasn't that really clever? It's just stupid, man. It was just so fucking stupid.
Yeah.
You know, the music's fine for 83. I mean, I guess that's the thing, and you kind of talked about it. So it's a box office failure or flop, yeah, or whatever. From what I read, there may be some part of this that's due to the distribution company that they selected, not right. having a lot of experience in this. Okay, so, and listen, box office success or failure does not directly equate to whether a movie was good or not. And there are plenty of movies that didn't do well in a theater setting that did really well on television. Office Space is a really big example
yeah,
of this.
For sure.
And so everybody you know has seen Office Space, but nobody you know saw it in the movie theater.
Right.
And so it's not that Eddie and the Cruisers is bad because it failed at the box office. And I can see that because of A, you know, the in 1983, the cultural zeitgeist of the time is kind of music video like you're talking about. I mean, this is a new thing. I mean, honestly, HBO is kind of cultural zeitgeist of the time, that now we have cable television and you pay to have these movies without commercials. And it's this whole big deal.
Yeah.
And having that kind of crammed down your throat, even though that sounds sexy, it's just, maybe that's the affinity that people have towards a movie like this, is that it's not good. It's just a comfort. It's like a blanket that your grandma made. It's not the best blanket in the world, but yeah. to you, because you slept with it as a kid, it just feels that way. And I just have to think that that's more of the appeal. You said, you know, I challenge people who've seen this to watch it again, and maybe like your wife will come away saying, well, that didn't really hold up, or maybe it's cornier, or maybe you start to recognize, because you and I are captive audiences for these movies. We are sitting down to watch them and to kind of maybe not pick them apart, but to look at them with a critical eye. And we have to, because we're comparing them to another movie. Maybe in 1983 or 4, when this is on HBO nonstop, you're not really sitting down to watch it. Maybe it's on while you're doing something else. And so I just think when you sit down, it just starts to become thin as tissue paper, like the whole thing. So obviously for me, not ever having seen it before, that's my only experience with it.
Right.
Is now also this movie doesn't stream fucking anywhere. So guess who got their iPad out and found a like Chechen website all in fucking Cyrillic.
Nice.
And I mean, I'm like, if I click play, like, is the whole iPad just going to blow up? Am I going to end up on some watch list as like a Russian sympathizer or something?
I hope you had your VPN up.
Yeah, I was on NordVPN. This movie brought to you by NordVPN. Nice. Your professionals in virtual networking. Yeah, I don't know. I just, man.
Well, so I agree with everything that you said. Again, it in the 80s, it was a different time, too. There was a lot of movies like these in the 80s that you watch today. There's good movies from the 80s. There's a lot of good movies from the 80s. But then there's a lot of these also rans that we hold fondly. But if I watched now, I'd be like, okay, well, the script might have been, could have used a little bit of polish. However, that being said, I will say that my wife might have said that she didn't think the movie held up, but she also still enjoyed it. It was also still, you know, that nostalgia aspect of it, the, you know, the fact that you know, Michael Paré is Eddie, and you've got these memories of that music video on the Dark Side still played on the radio. The thing is that you made an interesting point where you were talking about how Springsteen and those guys didn't sound like that in the 60s. And if you go back to the 60s, you had like Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons is big from that era, and bands of that nature that they're kind of emulating. But the thing is with Springsteen and John Cafferty and even like Billy Joel that came out in the early 70s to late 70s, they were inspired by those acts, but kind of put their own spin and kind of melded a 70s attitude with that 60s kind of doo-wop mentality. So it comes off as this hybrid, and you're right, doesn't necessarily fit in the 60s. However, in 1984, everybody was doing the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
You know, you had Billy Joel for Graffiti. The longest time. Yeah, American Graffiti for the longest time. So many songs, like you had the band Sha Na Na came out redoing.
Yeah, yeah.
Happy Days was a big show. Mm-hmm. So it was a reach back, and this was kind of another one of those things with Eddie and the Cruisers where it was kind of that nostalgic reach back to the 50s and 60s. So that it identified with people. But overall, the movie, the plot needs a lot of work. And the part of the reason is that a lot of people don't realize it, that Eddie and the Cruisers is based on a book, but the book itself is about a murder mystery about who killed Eddie Wilson. And what they tried to do was incorporate those elements of the book in with the script of making it a biopic. And the two don't mesh very well together. They needed to be one or the other. The book was not intended to be a musical. It was intended to be this noir story about a musician who is murdered and who did it and why and what for. And they tried to combine the two. And that's where I think they went wrong with it. Is it, like I said, it could have been a lot of fun. Somebody in the chat said that they love, that's a Zvi Hirsch, as a matter of fact. I prefer Eddie and the Cruisers 2, Eddie Lives, which honestly I have a still from. We'll have to challenge Eric to take some time to watch,
to watch this one. I'm not doing that. So, I mean, that is him, though, at the end.
Yes.
We know this, and that's, like, established, I guess, from Eddie and the Cruisers 2, or what?
Yeah, he didn't die. In fact, he went to Canada, and he is, I can't remember. I have been a long time since I watched it, but he was, like, a steel worker or a factory worker in Canada, and he starts getting into the bar scene and playing music again, and it reignites.
What the fuck, dude? You had the chance to do all this before, and you faked your own death and moved to Canada.
He burned himself out. That's what happened to poor Eddie.
He had, what, 12 songs?
But I like how he grew a mustache and no one could recognize him.
Man.
It's good.
It's not, well, you mentioned, so I did read that it was based on a book. I don't read books, as you probably know.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Is Us Weekly a book? Is that considered a book?
Is that your favorite?
Yeah. I don't know. I get a lot of news from there.
Okay.
Did you know that Machine Gun Kelly and Tekashi 6ix9ine are expecting a baby?
Are they? Is that in like the Weekly World News?
Yeah. But
yeah,
they did try to do that film noir thing.
Yes.
But it's that only works when there's like anything remotely either mysterious or nefarious, or there's an underlying something. There wasn't any of that. Hey, Vinny Cataldo
in the chat.
He was like graduating middle school when we met him, and now he's a doctor. So good for you, Vinny.
Yeah, good to have him in the chat. Thanks to everybody that's in the chat. Real quick, before we get into the next movie, we want to thank everybody for tuning in to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric's live stream. If you're listening to this on one of the many podcast providers that we are on, thank you so much. We're on Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple Podcasts, and many others. Please tell your friends, tell them to subscribe. Make sure that you subscribe to either our YouTube or Twitch or our Facebook Live or all three. And as always, if you want to email us any comments, you can do so at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. So we were talking about Eddie and the Cruisers. And Eddie and the Cruisers 2, Eddie Lives. I am going to watch Eddie and the Cruisers 2 because it's been a long time since I watched it. Just, I'm home teleworking, so I could just put it on tomorrow and just have it on in the background and enjoy it. Are you okay, Eric? Everything all right?
I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out, like, if that movie was that bad. And I just want to see.
You want to see the IMDb on it? People like Eddie and the Cruisers 2. Some people prefer it because it's more straightforward. You don't get the, I will say this. I remember enjoying it from the fact that you don't get all the murder mystery stuff and that kind of, it's more of a straightforward, you know, resurrection story of his music career.
He's in Montreal. He's a Quebecois.
Yeah, in Canada. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Eddie and the Cruisers has an IMDb rating of 7 out of 10.
There you go.
That feels a little high to me.
People love the movie.
I'm not saying that it's a two. I'm not, you know, we watched some pretty bad fucking movies, and this isn't that. I get it. I still think 7's a little high. But Eddie and the Cruisers 2 has a 6.2 on here. So you can say, and listen, it's all a matter of personal preference.
Right.
It's just that your preferences are wrong. It sounds like.
All right. So we'll see what everybody thinks about it in the chat. I did put the poll out there to vote for which one of these you liked better. There's some votes for Eddie and the Cruisers out there, but we're going to go in. What's that?
What?
There are people prefer it, but again, depends on what generation you're in and what you remember fondly. But now we're going to get into the next movie, which came out in 2000. And it's also another movie about a band that, is not real in existence, but they're a pretty damn good band. And that's the movie Almost Famous with Kate Hudson. So many people in this. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Patrick Fugit. I think it's Fugit or Fugit. I don't know.
Francis McDormand,
Billy Crudup, Jason Lee, a ton of cameos, which we'll talk about. Ton of bit parts of people that were fairly famous in the movie. And it's a love story to the era and music of the 70s. You know, this movie takes place in 1973 about a young boy who is really, you know, getting out there. He wants to be a rock journalist, and he grows up in kind of a sheltered household with his mother, who is very overbearing, but let's just be honest, wonderfully played by Frances McDormand. It's one of her best roles ever. She when she's on screen, you can't take your eyes off of her. She commands your attention.
She has the ability to take any character and make them complex just because she's the one playing it. And like you said, he's growing up in this sheltered environment. I know about this. This is the way I grew up. And the way she acted differs from my experience growing up, because at the very least, it seemed through the strictness that she cared, that this isn't punishment. This is because I'm worried, because I'm scared. You can get other actresses to play this role, and it just becomes pretty one-dimensional, that it's just about the punishment. It's just about I'm strict. It's just about whatever. And just that she's playing that part, she's so, like you said, she's so good. She's so good in everything. Yeah. And she's only on screen for 5 minutes of this thing and still just so good.
What they do really well with the opening 15, 20 minutes is tell this story of the kid when he's younger, William Miller. And he has been skipped to several grades in the scene that's on the screen right now in our live stream. He gets skipped several grades, and his mother doesn't let him know how old he really is.
Yes.
He looks in the mirror. And honestly, yeah, I think that a few of us kind of nerdy kids that wanted to be cool when we were younger really could identify with this role. And this is based on a semi-autobiographical account of the director and writer, Cameron Crowe, who grew up in this environment, wanted to be cool. And has an older sister. I had an older sister that, you know, listened to 70s rock and was always in the basement jamming and all her friends over. And here I am, the little spud, you know, just trying to be a part of that. And, you know, you tell the kid loves his sister and she can't handle being in this repressive environment. And that whole thing, Zooey Deschanel, again, whatever you think about her in that, I actually kind of like Zooey, but she is great in this. Cameron Crowe really got the best out of everybody in this film because it really has some of the best performances I've seen of any of these actors. And Zooey Deschanel, her scene where she rips into her mother and then makes her listen to Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, what kid didn't play a song for their parents, you know, and go, listen to what it's saying. You're not listening to me, so listen to this song. It's a great moment. It's the opening 20 minutes of this film. It sets the tone for what you're about to see. And it really, if that were most of the film, that would be okay. Cause it's really, really good.
Yeah. They start off with the most thoughtful part of they kind of bookend it with the most thoughtful parts and then fill the middle with how we kind of bridge from here to there. And like often happens in these movies, the idea that maybe what you thought you wanted isn't all it's cracked up to be. And I mean, we watch it play out in real time, but it's, again, it's cradled with the most thoughtful, sensitive, you know, from the mom to the kid to just the Band-Aids kind of adopting him in this matronly role, the band dynamics, you know, just all of it. It's a really well thought out way to tell the story. The story itself is great. The way he tells the story is also really, really great. So I wanted to ask you this.
Yes.
For those of you who haven't listened to the show before or just aren't paying attention a lot, which is fine. We're not asking you to pay attention. We're asking you to listen. Greg knows about movies. Greg is so interested in movies that he went to and got a graduate degree in movie shit. I think that's what it is, right?
Yes, Masters that's exactly in movie what it
shit,
is.
MMS. And I don't know anything about movies. So on occasion, I'll watch some of these and go, okay, well, this is what I'm kind of experiencing, or this is what I'm taking out of it. But I want to ask Greg, because Greg has much more of a sense of what a movie is and the structure of movies. This, to me, almost kind of felt like one of those, like, Odysseus, like, growing up adventure tales. And I wondered if I'm way off base with that, or if that movie structure, I mean, that storytelling structure, which is as old as written, you know, entertainment itself. Do you pick up on something like that? Am I off base? Where are you seeing that?
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat a little bit of Alice Through the Looking Glass. It's so much of that being to see behind the curtain. I have the bootleg cut of this film, which is like 2 hours and 45 minutes, if I'm not mistaken. So the extra long version, it has got a lot of special features. And the director, writer, Cameron Crowe, who, you know, he's done Jerry Maguire and a lot of other films, Say Anything, which is a great film from the 80s. And he talks about a lot of people tell you, write what you know. And he had told this story to many friends and everybody kept asking him, why aren't you telling this story? And it is a coming of age story. It's about how he found out where he belonged. And he realized that the way he put it in the documentary about the film is when he got to go backstage and meet the Allman Brothers Band, because this is semi-biographical about several bands that he went on tour with, Allman Brothers, The Who, and Led Zeppelin, who he spent a lot of time with each one of these. But Greg Allman is kind of where Russell Hammond is based on. He called him a narc when they first met him because he was young and they didn't trust him. But when he got backstage and the rock stars started treating him like family, and he said he never wanted to leave. He wanted to stay there forever because it was a world that was so much different than the real world that was out there that you had to face. But everything comes to an end. And so, yeah, it's that story. It's a very big journey. And you experience it. You know, William Miller is the focal point of the film, and you experience so many other lives through what he sees. But that isn't that what our life is all like? You know, we experience our view of it, our point of view, but we literally see other people's lives unfold in front of our eyes from the beginning to the end. And we don't even know it while we're watching it. When we think back on how people have touched us in certain ways and how they've, become a part of who we are as individuals, it makes it a large impact. I had a very, very close friend that I've known, had known since the year 2000, and we were military buddies, and he committed suicide, very hard for me to talk about, in 2018. All I could say when he passed was, his story was over now. And his story was part of my story, but his part in my story is now over. And I have to face that. And almost famous to me is looking through William Miller's eyes at all of these characters that he is loving and watching all of their challenges. And you see that. It's so interesting. Eyes are a big part of this film. They focus on the eyes so much. In fact, the movie poster with Kate Hudson, you got the two eyes with the glasses and all the things in the lenses of the sunglasses. That's not by accident. It's about what you see. In fact, this image that I have up here, eyes, Zooey Deschanel telling her brother, one day you'll be cool. And it's an amazing scene. It's how his sister impacted his life. My sisters and my older brother did this for me when I was a kid. I really love this scene because when I was a kid, my sister, my older sister Donna, gave me my very first Beatles record. She was moving out and gave me a box of 45s. And the very first Beatle record I ever owned was Love Me Do on one side, Parlophone, and you flipped it over and it was P.S. I Love You. And I played that sucker over and over again. I was fascinated by it. And one of the reasons wasn't just because it was good music to me. It was that connection that my sister had given it to me. My sister loved it, and that infected me. And that's one of the things this movie does really, really well. It touches on these human connections that he makes. They don't ever make the mistake that this is not about William Miller. This is William Miller's story. But they do so much with the interpersonal relationships that you get to know everybody else and what their struggles are. And these subplots really affect you emotionally. It's just done extremely well. So yeah, as a film student, I think that is one of the more flawlessly written screenplays. It did win the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay in 2000, and it deserved it.
And Roger Ebert, it was his movie of the year for the year 2000, I believe. Yep. You know, it's celebrated. I mean, it's only a 7.9. That seems weird to me. Seems awfully low. You know, as I was watching this again, this isn't a movie about as much as it's a movie about this kid, right? Mm. And so then I'm thinking, well, are we a little off base with this one? But to your point, the band is the vehicle for his growth, for the experience that kind of takes him from who he is in the beginning of this movie to who he is in the end. And they do enough with the band. The music is good. We see the infighting. We see the jealousy. We see the, you know, Jason Lee's character. You know, he says it out loud. It's not like it's a secret. It's not like it's implied. So we had an agreement, you know, I was going to be the lead singer and the front man, and you were just the guitarist. And now our star has turned, you know,
the guitarist with mystique.
Yeah. It's mystique.
Which means he's mysterious, which means keep your fucking mouth shut.
Yeah.
And yeah, the jealousy that does affect a lot of bands.
Yeah. And so we watch that play out. There's a really interesting scene where they're taking the private jet and they hit some turbulence and they're all kind of telling secrets or, you know, kind of coming clean about things they feel. And, you know, in a kind of comic relief part of that, the plane doesn't crash and everything's fine. And everyone kind of looks around and has to live with their, you know, newfound honesty. it's interesting to me because from start to finish, it tells a cohesive story, a cohesive tale. It's well-structured. It's well thought out. But then there are these little montages along the way that maybe don't directly inform our main character, maybe don't even directly inform the story, but just add enough color to make this feel real. And I think that's the part of it that, whether you know it or not, when you're watching Almost Famous, it feels like a real thing. Now, it's based on a true story, but right, obviously a lot of that's going to be some artistic license, liberties taken. It's already an amalgamation of three different bands and three different kind of sets of travels and three different groups of people, all kind of made into one. But this feels real, and it feels real because, I mean, I think the writing and the performances, but because there are little things that happen along the way. Because think about your obituary, right? All they say is, you know, so-and-so was born on this day. They died on this day. They worked here for however long. They had some kids. Those kids had some kids. In lieu of flowers, donate to what the fuck ever.
Yeah.
Well, there's your whole life written down. You know, you lived, yep. I mean, if you're lucky, you lived 80 years, and they put your obituary in about six sentences this big in the newspaper, and that's the accumulation of everything you ever did in your life. But we know life's not like that. Life is little, teeny, teeny, tiny moments. Ah, man, I've had a really hard time the last couple of days because I'm really busy at work and the kids aren't having school because of the weather. And it's been a little overwhelming and it's been a little frustrating. I mean, it's hard to get my work done without getting frustrated. And then there'll just be little moments where I look over and Greer's, you know, doing something cute. She's watching something about yoga on the TV, and she went and put on like what she thought yoga clothes would look like, you know, and got a bath towel and set it down, and that's her yoga mat. That, in the grand scheme of things, probably isn't important, but it's things like that that color our world, that color our existence, that color how mundane life can be. And that's what makes this movie, I think, just go from good to great, is that there's enough of those colorful moments that don't necessarily mean anything that make it feel like a real movie, that make me feel like if I close my eyes, I could have been that guy. I wanted to be a writer, Greg. I went to college as a journalism major. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do sports writing, and I thought I would write for the Dallas Morning News, and I'd cover the Texas Rangers. That's what I wanted to do. Glad I didn't, you know, the newspaper industry. And here I am in my late 40s, you know, that'd have been a tough pivot.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, the, and I kind of felt the same way. I was kind of a geeky, not kind of, I mean, I was a geeky, dweeby kid, not particularly popular. And if I was popular, it was popular like Screech was popular on Saved by the Bell, you know?
Right.
But I always thought, you know, if I was a really good writer and then I got a job working at the Dallas Morning News and I was in the clubhouse with Major League Baseball players. And at the time it was like, for me, Mitch Williams and Pete Incaviglia and Oda B. McDowell and Rafael Palmeiro and, you know, Texas Rangers. And I was like, well, that would be cool. Kind of like he feels like, you know, getting in with a band and traveling around. I just thought, man, if I was the beat writer and I was in the lock, I was in that clubhouse, you know, 81 games a year, and I'd get to know these guys, and, you know, I did, to me, that was my Almost Famous dream, right?
Yeah.
I can't say enough about how well done I think the movie is. And again, I keep kind of making the point and then veering away from it, which I am wont to do. So I'm not apologizing for it. But I just do think those moments of color are what make this go from feeling like a movie to feeling almost like you're watching real life.
And oh, for sure.
To go from good to great, to go yeah. from interesting to impactful. I think that's what this movie does the very best.
Yeah, I agree. It's when I mentioned my friend who passed away, there's so many others. When you're like, I was in the military for 22 years, active service, and you meet so many people and you move around a lot. So there are mm-hmm. people in my life that I was friends with for 3 years. I had two friends that lost their lives in a car accident. They were actually, it was a weekend and they were going up to go fishing in Alabama. We were stationed in Montgomery, Alabama, and I was going to go with them, but I was too lazy to get my ass up out of bed, and somebody ran them off the road and they went off for overpass. I worked with them in the emergency room. And when I found out, I was devastated. But these are guys I'd only really known for about a year, but I hung out with them. You know, we worked together. We worked night shift together. So we were there watching movies all night long in the emergency room. And now they were gone. And I went to their memorial service. I still have their programs. And you think about people like that. Then, like you said, they may not contribute to the major parts of the story, but they're always going to be a part of the story. And I look back at not just people that I was close with that aren't with us anymore, but people that are almost closer than family to me over the course of my life and the people that I've encountered. When you take that inventory of where you're at a certain point in your life and you look back on everything that colored that life, it's really fascinating. And that's what the movie, I think, really does exceptionally well. One of the things that they talk about, somebody that colored William Miller's life, is played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, and that's the character of Lester Bangs, who is a real person that was the head of Cream Magazine. And they didn't change his name on purpose because they asked Lester if they could use his real name in the film, and he gladly carried it on. And Philip Seymour Hoffman met with Lester Bangs, and Lester was very instrumental in Cameron Crowe's life, William Miller in the movie. And the scene on the top right where they're walking down, Cameron Crowe said it was so surreal to have 60 people out there filming a scene that was part of his life, that really happened when he first met Lester, and they went walking and just talked about music for hours. And he said that he used to call Lester in the middle of the night because Lester would say, "I'm always here with my records. I'm always up late. I got nothing better to do. You can always call me." Another masterful performance by Philip Seymour Hoffman in his film. And again, he's not in it for very long, maybe 15 minutes of total screen time, maybe. But he's so impactful. And again, he's not a major plot player, but he influences William Miller, what he does. He gives him that advice. Don't let the bands make yeah. you think they're your friend. They're not your friend. You know, you are the enemy. And then, like I've got here on the bottom right, that's an industry of cool. They just want you to make them look cool. And he has to keep that in the back of his mind. And the one thing is that William Miller, he can't get over the fact that he wants to be friends with them. And he keeps letting that cloud his judgment until ultimately when he tries to tell the truth, it's almost like a betrayal. But they've been betraying him since the beginning. They never cared about him the way he thought.
Yeah.
And it is, I'm sure, what Cameron Crowe himself went through in real life, where he was just trying to be this nice kid writing about these stars. But if they wrote anything true, then they would turn on him and again, call him the narc and be nasty toward him. But it when we talk about these characters, you know, like that's Philip Seymour Hoffman plays and the members of the band that we talk about, it's really cool to see just the different pieces that they have. Like you mentioned, somebody that like where they spend some time with a character and they may not really contribute to the plot well. One of those people is Sapphire, which is Fairuza Balk. She's one of the Band-Aids. They give her way more to do in the film than they do in most other films. But she's got a really key part to play. She's the one that kind of keeps telling William Miller what a joke all this is. And she has one of the best moments at the end of the film when everything's kind of wrapping up and things are changing. And she's at the buffet line and she's talking about these new girls. They're not here for the music. And she's lived it. She's lived that it was there about the music and that's all it was. And so she, even though she's not Penny Lane, she has a massive amount of impact on the story. But you can't not talk about this film, and there's Fairuza Balk in the middle there of the three Band-Aids. You can't talk about this film and not talk about Kate Hudson as Penny Lane. You just, it is probably her best role ever. I don't see how she'll ever do anything better than this. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for the Oscars and lost, but so was Frances McDormand, was nominated for, I think she should have been nominated for Best Actress, because she is the female lead of this film, without a doubt, hands down.
Yep. So, and I'm glad we got to this part, because this was, I mean, she's the one on the cover of this, you know, movie poster. And she in particular, but the Band-Aids as a whole, kind of act as this, almost kind of carrying him from one situation or scene into another. And it's kind of fairy godmother-esque in a way, where we've been on the road. You know, we have this wealth of knowledge. We know what it's like. Now, she's got problems of her own, right? Because when we meet her and it's just about the music and we're not groupies, we're Band-Aids. But it could be argued that it's even kind of, and I don't mean sad as in me being judgmental about being a groupie. Like, I don't give a shit. You know, do your thing, right? But to convince yourself that you're in it for the music and that you're not in it for that. But what's really happening is you desperately are longing for an actual relationship with someone who's like not ever going to give you that, I think is even sadder than just kind of random sex, because sex is fun, right? And so, you know, she's outwardly bubbly and outwardly encouraging and outwardly motherly. And then internally, there's conflict, there's sadness, there's a desire to be loved, there's a desire to be respected and appreciated that she's not getting. You know, there's a really, and I mean, I think the most devastating scene in the movie for me is they have this poker game and she kind of gets lost in a poker game to another band. She takes the news outwardly really well, right? Jokes about it, laughs about it. And then everyone kind of walks away. You can tell she's absolutely crushed. And I mean, the acting is great. Again, just that scene in a nutshell of just, you tell yourself that these are the things that you want. You tell yourself that these are the things that are going to make me feel fulfilled. These are the things that are going to make me feel, that'll make my self-esteem better, make me feel better about myself. And I'm chasing it and I'm really not feeling any better, but now I'm kind of too far into this, you know? I mean, and maybe I find that poignant and maybe I found that really powerful because I've had those same issues of, you know, being a dweeb and wanting to fit in made it really easy to do some things that I am not really proud of in my 20s, you know, early 20s, mid 20s, just because I thought, you know, if I could just be cool, you know, I was in a band. I was a full-time musician and didn't have much responsibility. And it was easy to just think, well, I'll feel really good about myself if people think I'm cool. That, I mean, that was the bottom line. And it informs a lot of, you know, your decision-making and the things that you do. So I think maybe having that experience, and maybe we all, to some extent, have that experience of wanting to fit in, of wanting to feel good about ourselves, of wanting to feel like we're appreciated. And so watching that scene specifically, and you had pulled up on here probably the other big scene with her of the overdose.
Yeah.
on Quaaludes in the hotel. But I think honestly, for me, it's that look on her face as the crowd dissipates and she realizes that what she thought was going to give her fulfillment and what she had based kind of her entire existence around was worth $50.
It was one of those things where William, who had been a confidant and a friend and had been a listener all of this time, that she had kind of used as kind of a buffer. She saw some beautiful things in him, and she mentions that she wishes Russell was more like William, and then he just snaps, and he tells her about this deal, about this bet, and how that Russell gambled on her and lost. And that hits her so hard, because not only is she learning that Russell doesn't care about her as much as she thinks, that he's never leaving his wife, that's it. But it's William delivering the news, the one person that she counted to always listen to her. And you're right. She does this thing. Kate Hudson does this thing where she acts like it doesn't bother her. And then she laughs, but tears fill up her eyes. They fall down her cheeks. She wipes them away. And then she goes back to laughing. It is, you want to show somebody how to act, show them that scene. And Kate, what I feel bad about for Kate Hudson is that after this, she got saddled with every rom-com down the pike. Now, granted, she made a lot of money that way, you know, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and everything. They're not bad films, but she is a very good actress. And while we're on the topic, I just want to mention, the wife and I just saw her new film with Hugh Jackman called Song Sung Blue, which is about a husband and wife who decide
love Neil Diamond.
Yes. They decide to form a Neil Diamond tribute band, they call it a Neil Diamond Experience. And Hugh Jackman does the singing, and she sings. She's a singer in real life. She has albums that she's released. She loves to sing, and they both do their own singing in the film. The music is great. The fact that they do this Neil Diamond thing, The acting is great. They've got Michael Imperioli from The Sopranos, who was Christopher Moltisanti. He's one of the friends. Everybody in it, it's a feel-good thing where all these people are coming together to make their dream come true. And they have to deal, and I'm not going to spoil it, because it's more than that. It's much more than that. They have to deal with the harsh realities of life in this movie, that not all your dreams are going to come true just because you have dreams. Things don't always work out the way we want them to, and we just have to hold on to the moments that we get that make us happy. And Kate Hudson, again, she's nominated for Best Actress this year for that movie. I don't think she'll win, because the girl from Hamnet is predicted to win, but I wish she would, because she was phenomenal again. And I'm like, this is what I've missed from Kate Hudson, is these gut-wrenching, really good dramatic performances. She's very, very capable of doing it. I think she's very underrated as an actress.
You know what she needs to do is go get one of those roles like Halle Berry in Monsters Ball. Yeah. Is that what it was? Yeah. Or Charlize Theron.
Yeah.
What's the movie?
She did Monster. Monster?
Yeah. Or the other way to do it is the Leonardo DiCaprio What's Eating Gilbert Grape, or what's the with Sean Penn?
I Am Sam. So she Rain Man.
Rain Man. Yeah,
they talk about that in Tropic Thunder. You got to be careful how far you go.
You don't want to go full. So she needs to pivot to like playing midget. Like Gary Oldman.
Tiptoes. In Tiptoes, yeah. Could be good. That could be good. Well, I'll say this. I recommend Song Sung Blue if you want to see her act again. She's great in Almost Famous. She really captivates in Almost Famous. You fall in love with her as a character. You feel for her. You could tell William is in love with her, and why wouldn't you be? And it's one of those things, like Cameron Crowe talked about it in the making of that I watched, where he was in love with Penny Lane, because everybody was in love with Penny Lane. And, you know, he asked her if he could use her story in the film. And she graciously said he ran into her. And this is 20 years later. And she still was full of charisma. She still had so much spirit in her. And so that comes through. Kate Hudson plays it so well. They couldn't have picked anybody better. But we're overlooking some of the other key components of the film. I do want to, you know, the band itself, Billy Crudup and Jason Lee, they do a great job as Stillwater. And that's why we're really talking about this movie. It's because, it's like you said, this is supposed to be about movie bands. This is the contest, not so much how great it is, but is this movie about a movie band one of the best ever? I would say that the music is outstanding. We haven't even talked about that yet. And I don't want to, you know, spend a full hour on this film. I could spend more. But I will say the music itself is a credit to, like we talked about Eddie and the Cruisers, right? They're trying to do a movie set in the 60s, music from the 60s, and it doesn't quite sound, it sounds more 70s and 80s than it does 60s. Not so with Almost Famous. Okay. There's a reason why these songs sound like they came right out of the 70s, even though this movie was done in the year 2000. Cameron Crowe's wife at the time was Nancy Wilson of Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Heart and was friends with Peter Frampton, Peter Frampton, who has one of the most iconic albums of the 70s. And they got together and wrote these songs for this film.
It feels authentic.
Yeah, it's great.
It feels like I could have heard these songs on the classic rock station growing up. Of course, the classic rock station here now plays Smashing Pumpkins and Pearl Jam. So that's weird and off-putting. But yeah, I'd read that he's married to Nancy Wilson. And I mean, yeah, you said Frampton Comes Alive is one of the biggest albums. Oh, are you going to show us your vinyl?
Yeah. So I have the Stillwater album on vinyl, and there's six songs on it. It's unbelievable because, granted, it was, wasn't Jason Lee who sang. It was Marty Fredrickson, I think, who is a great songwriter. He's written songs with Ozzy Osbourne. He was brought in and did the vocals. But the band plays great. Peter Frampton plays guitar. It's such a throwback to through the 70s. And I also did want to show, I got this for Christmas, this box set of the vinyl. It's six LPs. I'm not going to show you everything, but it comes with, you don't know if you can see this on the live stream, it comes with William Miller's notebook from the movie. So it's got all the stuff that he wrote on his notebook pad on there, all the Led Zeppelin stuff. You can see that. It's got
very cool.
It's got tickets to the actual shows for Stillwater in there. It's got the Rolling Stone article.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. So it's got some neat stuff in it. But it's a great set. And the soundtrack, just to talk about that real quick, Stillwater does great and they're a part of it, but the soundtrack itself is just filled with so many great songs of that era. It has the highest budget of any film, music budget. I think that the average movie was about $1.5 million that they spent on music budget, and Almost Famous spent $3.5 million on the rights to all the songs that they put in this film. It's just crazy.
Man, okay, look, I'm not like do your own research guy, but wouldn't the Forrest Gump soundtrack with all those, I mean, first of all, it was a double album and was top to bottom hits. I have a hard time believing.
So they
didn't spend more.
One, and then this is two albums. And then this is another one. And then this is another one. So, this has 12 different sides to it of just nothing but 70s rock original, like other than the Stillwater stuff. So I agree with you. Forrest Gump does a lot, but a lot of that stuff too, it was easier to get the rights to 50s and 60s music than 70s at the time when they did this. So you're spending a lot more money for Elton John than you would for like the Shirelles. So although I think the Forrest Gump soundtrack is probably, they probably have a lot on there. But this one was way overcharged, but Cameron Crowe said it was worth it to have those original songs. And one of my favorites is the scene where Russell Hammond does the the swan dive off of the swimming pool when he gets drunk and says he's on drugs and jumps off of it. And it's the where he gets off of the roof and he's all completely, you know, coming onto the bus and he's freezing cold and they start playing Tiny Dancer. And it's probably one of the just one of those moments that you didn't have to put this in the film.
Yeah.
It goes on very long. They play most of the song, but it's the idea of what it is. It's like he gets on the bus, you see on this still here, and people are pissed that he's derailed this tour. And then he sits down, and it's the healing power of music. And the one guy, the bass player, who is hilarious, he doesn't get to do a lot in the film, but he is funny when he does get to do something. He starts humming the song, and then everybody else starts singing along. And by the end, they're singing it full at the top of their lungs, just belting out the song. And it makes everybody laugh and it makes everybody calm down. And I think that's the whole point of the scene is how important the music was. I am one of the things that Lester Bangs says is that I'm up till 4 a.m. I'm up late every night playing my records. And that's one of the things that I love to do. I can be alone with just my vinyl. And I don't need somebody to be there with me so that I can play it for them because it's not really for them.
Yeah.
It's for me. And I have a massive collection. And part of the reason I have that collection and that I'm addicted to it, unfortunately, to my own detriment, because I spend way too much money on it, is that every record that I have means something to me. And the songs themselves have a place in my life, one part of it. And so when I think of something and I want to have it, I've got to have it on vinyl so I can sit there and put it on there. A lot of people would be like, well, why don't you just do streaming? You can get everything you want on your phone. Yes, that's true. And I could do that. But it's so impersonal to the fact of being able to pick this record up and holding the picture, looking at the back, looking at everything that's on it, opening up the gatefold, having so much more to do, holding on to it, putting the needle on and not being restricted to just when I'm listening to it on streaming service, I listen to one song, maybe two, and then I'm on to the next album. This I'm at least going to listen to one side because I'm not going to get up and change the record.
Yeah.
And then I'm listening to more of the album than I normally would. And then I'm listening to songs that I might not have listened to because or it may not have been experienced. So it's just a different experience. People, you know, it's not whether it sounds better or not. It's the experience of living that I love about vinyl. And that's this movie. And it's clear because the records they show that his sister gives him were actually Cameron Crowe's real albums that he really had that he used in the film to kind of demonstrate it. It's a demonstration of the fact that of what music does for each individual and how important it can be to shape your life. And this movie is, it's about a lot of different things, but that's at the central core of it is how the influence of music can build your life and it can tear it apart, can give you life, it can take it away. And I really enjoyed that about the film.
Well, there's an intimacy to music that, you know, and whatever your motivation for listening is, you know, I know people who don't really listen to the words of songs. You know, they just like music because of the production value or the instrumentation or the, you know, a lot of people obviously listen to jazz and more jazz than not doesn't have vocals. I mean, yeah, there's the Great American Songbook of Vocal Jazz. And for me, there's an Elton John song, Sad Song Say So Much.
Mm-hmm.
And when he says, when someone else is suffering enough to write it down and every single word makes sense, then it's easier to have those songs around. And I think about that all the time when I hear something and I'm just looking around, like, did anybody else just hear what this person said? There's a connection. Music connects us. It connects us in the ways that we see in the movie, in the way you were talking about, where older siblings introduce younger siblings to music, or the actual physical act of handing over records. There's that connection. There's also the connection of humanity, and we've talked about this on the show before. Who among us hasn't had their heart broken? Who among us hasn't dealt with you know, longing for something that's just not going to be. Who among us hasn't felt, you know, all of these things. And it's not just that we've all felt that. You'd think, and we've proven as a species, we are incapable of taking that and applying it to at a macro level, you know, that the people that you're blaming for all of this country's problems got the same fucking problems you've got, if not worse. We just, you know, for whatever reason, we are not capable of doing that. But no. With music, it starts to feel like we're in this together. I think that festivals show that. I think that, you know, shared experiences at concerts in, like you said, you can sit there and listen to your vinyl by yourself. It's for you. But there is a lot of value in some of my favorite memories with my best friend, Josh, are him showing me music or him patiently allowing me to show him music and just, you know, that sense of humanity and camaraderie and friendship. Like, that's what music does to us. I think it does it to us or for us in a way that movies just can't. Music songs are 3 to 4 minutes long. Movies are 1.5 to 2 hours long. It's a digestible piece of emotion that I can feed you because we're friends. And I go, Greg, you've got to hear this. I don't know if you've heard of this, whatever, check it out. And then 1 hour later you text me back and go, Jesus, dude, that was really good. I'm so glad you sent that to me. It just does that in a way. So building a movie around that is so, I mean, smart.
Yeah.
It's just such a really good way to immediately connect with an audience and to put everybody on an even level playing field, because there's not, you know, so I've made jokes before about like on dating profiles or something, and it'd be like likes, and it's like music. Yeah, no shit. Like, everybody likes music. Now, what kind of music? You know, maybe we wouldn't be compatible.
Yeah.
But, like, we all like music. We all, to a man and to a woman, have something that when we hear it, hits us square in the fucking jaw.
Right.
And I mean, I'm getting chills. It's important to the way movies are important to you. Music is important to me. And I think, I mean, what better setting for a movie than building it around something that we all share and we all hold so deeply and so intimately and so, I mean, I think that's what, that intimacy is what vinyl is so good for. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like people who quit smoking and then they don't miss being a smoker, but sometimes you miss the kind of ritual of it.
Yep.
And there's a ritual to, like you said, opening up the vinyl, taking it out of the sleeve, you know, opening up your record player, moving the needle out of the way, setting it down, the crackle as, you know, right before the song starts. That's very ritualistic. It's very intimate. It kind of sets you at ease. You know what you're about to get into. And I just think, you know, I mean, obviously all 8 of the movies that we are watching for this, for these matchups are about bands. So they're going to be about music. But I think of the, you know, ones we've watched so far, this one really gets to the heart of what is music? Why is music? How is music, you know, the effect it has on people. And that's even without all of the other stuff we talked about, the coming of age, the, you know, the matronly band-aids, the overbearing protective mother, just that part of it would be enough to be awesome. And then you've got all the rest of this.
There's so much that literally could devote another hour. We're not going to do that. I'm sure we can talk more about the things we didn't discuss during the final four, because this one we're going to declare it right now that Almost Famous is definitely the winner of today's show. It is a great
yes, for sure.
Oops, I had the wrong button there. Here it is. There we go. It's Almost Famous winner tonight over Eddie and the Cruisers. This is what I was going to play.
It's like fucking Close Encounters or some shit.
It's just on the soundboard, dude. I just don't know. But anyway.
I have a question for you, though.
Yes.
A little lighter than that. What was your favorite cameo in this?
Oh, that's a good question. I think my favorite, and I'm going to bring up the stills of some of the cameos. There was so many that they went through. Because even isn't David Lynch like really quickly like in a cab somewhere just when he puts his head in the cab? That's amazing. But you had Jimmy Fallon in here, just the ones we got up on the screen. Jay Baruchel, I thought was hilarious, is the Led Zeppelin nut that follows them from. And again, it shows the power of music, how obsessed he is with Zeppelin. Rainn Wilson at Rolling Stone is one of the reporters there. Hilarious. But my favorite is in the top right here. Cage from Tenacious D as the DJ that's stoned. It's one of my favorite. And again, like you said earlier, doesn't need to be in the movie. It's just a scene where they're in the radio station talking about the record, but it's such a good scene where he basically falls asleep.
Well, but then after that, so it's like he's playing a character because he's all spaced out you know, and then he like you said, falls asleep and the band doesn't know what to do. And then they cut tape and he goes, well, I think that went really well, don't you guys? And like I died. So mine was going to be Kyle Gass.
Oh yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Because that was, you know, Mark Maron was in this.
Yeah. I mean, Mark Maron. Bunch. He is the guy that won't let him out of the gate. He runs the venue.
You bought a gate.
And they're kicking at each other. I mean, the film, especially if you watch the bootleg cut, the 2-hour and 40-minute version, it is, there's so many moments. And my wife actually said it better than I ever could. So we watched this one together after Eddie Cruisers. I think it was the next day we watched this. And we sat there and we both had, you know, we had got a couple glasses of wine, had some popcorn, we're going to watch a movie, turn the lights down. And we sat there for 2 hours and 40 minutes, not saying a word. When it was over and the credits are rolling, she turned to me and she said, wow, there is not a wasted moment in that film.
For 2 hours and 40 minutes.
And she said, that is about as perfect of a film as you can get. And she's like, I can't fault it. And that's the truth. If I were going to say anything negative, and this is a minor thing, is that I would have loved those concert sequences to last a little bit longer. Because when they're playing Fever Dog, I want to hear another 30 seconds of it. If you get I have the 4K of it. If you get the 4K, all the music's in their full entirety are in there. So you can watch the music videos, which is great. It's a great feature to have. But it's just, again, there's so much to love about it. It definitely deserves to win. I'm glad we both agree. I think knowing that you didn't really care for any of the Cruisers.
And Eddie and the Cruisers, I wanted the music to be over. And this one, I wanted it to, you know, to be more for sure. So,
without a doubt. So the next battle we're going to have is going to be in 2 weeks. And it's going to be a fun one, I think, for this one. I'm looking forward to this.
Man,
this is
not looking forward to this.
I'm looking forward to watching these two again. That Thing You Do, the Tom Hanks with the Wonders, which is a very fun movie. I think I'm going to watch the unrated cut, too, the director's cut, which is so much fun. And I'm going to watch the extended cut of the movie it's going up against, which is John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, a cast of thousands, so many singers. So many great musical numbers, the Blues Brothers, legendary film. Two bands that didn't really exist. Now, the Blues Brothers, and we'll talk about it in a couple weeks, did go on to continue to perform live, but they were not a real band when, you know, they were a skit on Saturday Night Live. And of course, That Thing You Do is Tom Hanks's creation. It's just a fantastic movie. So in 2 weeks, we are going to have that. One more time before we go, I do want to mention, if you do love the show, just tell a friend. You can always reach out and let them know that we are on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod, YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast, or on Facebook Live. All you got to do is search for Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Again, you can always email us your suggestions. We've got some great other categories coming up after we get through movie bans. We're not going to talk about those right now, but we got some good stuff coming up in the rest of this year. We're going to brave the cold to be able to bring these to you. We're going to do our best to get these out there. I can't wait till it warms up, because I do my version of the podcast in my basement. And it's freaking cold down here. I got a space heater right next to my leg.
Mr. Bigglesworth.
I know, exactly. So that's it. Thank you guys for joining us on YouTube tonight for the live stream. And we thank you for everybody who listens to us on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and many others for tuning in each and every week. Thank you so much. We couldn't do it without you. With that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Eric for his parting words of the night.
Thank you all once again for listening. Thank you for being with us. And remember, until next week, be excellent to each other, and we'll see you then.
See you guys in 2 weeks for Blues Brothers versus That Thing You Do on Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. We love you guys. We'll see you then.